I have to do that, then a coat. I'll be true American.
Okay, happy to introduce our first Institute for Global Health Speaker of the Year. My name is Sten Vermund. I direct the Institute for Global Health, and welcome back from holiday, everybody. Really pleased to introduce Dr. Sam Friedman, who works for NDRI, which is a very well-known research institute in New York City. They have had a very distinguished career in behavioral science, community intervention, risk reduction in drug users, have really been leading lights with strong support from NIDA, NIMH, CDC, and other funding agencies, state of New York. Sam is a social epidemiologist trained at Harvard and Michigan. You don't run into a social epidemiologist every day, someone who feels comfortable in the behavioral sciences, in the field of epidemiology, and also in a lot of the modeling issues that drive population dynamics of drug use, population dynamics of infectious disease. And I was especially pleased when he picked the title HIV and Hepatitis C, how they spread in the community and how drug injectors and others try to protect themselves and others. There's a sub-theme to Dr. Friedman's talk that has a lot to do with the concept of a network. And just for those of you who just won't necessarily get it, doctors are very good at individual intervention, right? Doctor-patient relationship. We sometimes deal with a dyad, you know, a couple, for example, or a mother and child, for example. We occasionally get engaged in communities through public health intervention, through partnerships with communities, through initiatives that our hospital or our institution does to upgrade a community, for example, screening and trying to raise consciousness about diabetes and blood pressure, or overseas for a malaria control program with bed nets. What gets left out is a network. And a network can have huge impact on drug use dynamics, infectious disease dynamics, sexually transmitted diseases. So keep in mind the network concept as Dr. Friedman presents his talk.
Thank you. There's not a lot more to say. He just said it all. Somewhere here, there used to be a computer where I had a button I could push.
That's what I'm supposed to do is orient you. You just pull out the thing and hit the button right there.
I'm going to pull this right up here. Makes life a lot easier. Okay. I do have to acknowledge a whole slew of grants from NIDA that has made the research on which this talk is based possible. There have been hundreds and hundreds of participants in these studies, many of whom have given us very confidential and secret things about themselves and trusted us with it. And, of course, the people we've worked with who have died of HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C over the years, and a lot of other folks. First, I'm going to talk about how these viruses spread through communities. And then I'm going to give some prevention insights based upon what we learned there. Now, a basic social research network is that risk networks carry infections by way of behaviors. And just to make clear what I mean by a risk network, let me start with this slide, which is based on the work of Valentia Rempel in Vancouver, where their team interviewed sex workers at massage parlors of one kind or another about the people who were their customers and asked them, what do you know what your customers do? Who else do they have sex with? And some of it is, this person from here might also go to this parlor and might also go to this parlor. And then there's some, these were the ones that were studied, but also some parlors that were not part of this study got mentioned. And also people have, you know, normal partners like spouses or other people they do stuff with and have sex with. So this is what they found as the network. Now, if you look at this as an epidemiology perspective and you ask yourself, what happens if they're not using condoms and there's any form of sexually transmitted agent there? And you can see it can spread through Vancouver very quickly, at least through that part of Vancouver. We did a study in a section of Brooklyn, New York, called Bushwick, where we've done a lot of studies, where we started with some young people aged 18 to 30 years old who were a reasonably representative sample of 18 to 30-year-olds in Bushwick. And also we started from a totally messily recruited sample of injection drug users. And we asked all these people in a long questionnaire that includes a lot of other questions, who else did you have sex with? Who did you have sex with? Who did you inject drugs with, if anyone? And stuff like that. And we followed then, if they said, hey, I have sex with Sam, we then go interview Sam and say, ask Sam, who do you have sex with or inject drugs with? And so forth. So we traced the networks through the community. And every time we interview somebody, we also take blood and urine from them and test them for a whole bunch of infectious agents. This is what it looks like for HIV. Now, this diagram you could probably spend several hours on looking at all the detail. The dark red people are injection drug users. The dark red lines are showing that those two people at either end injected drugs together. The yellow lines show that the people had sex together, and the blue lines show they did both together. Now the pink, let's see, there's a pink, there's a pink, there's a pink. Those folks are crack users. The folks who are lighter pink, as we thought it was, but it shows pretty much white, are people who use heroin or cocaine but don't smoke, crack, and don't inject drugs. And the people who are blue are none of the above. Now, the other thing here is we've also coded in who they have sex with in terms of, male with males, males with females, and such like. An upwards-facing triangle is a man who has sex with men. A downwards-facing triangle is a woman who has sex with women. A square is somebody like me. And a circle is a woman who has sex only with men. Now, you can spend hours on this, but I will point to you that this group, for example, is a group of people who go to gay organized sex parties. And what you can see is there's an awful lot of HIV there. There's an awful lot of particularly crack smoking, but also some drug injecting there. This place is another one of those epidemiologic or prevention agents nightmares. We got into that network very near the end of the study. And the result of that is that it does not connect to this big, huge, gigantic connected network. Undoubtedly, if we had more time to trace all their network connections, it would have connected. But we just didn't have time in the study. And I'm only showing you here the people who connected, who are part of a dyad where we recruited both members of the dyad. Individuals in the study who we never recruited any of their partners aren't in this diagram. That's a network. This is a network also, the same network, in fact, but here I'm showing you hepatitis C. Anyone with a plus has hepatitis C. Two things about this. First of all, you'll see an awful lot more hep C than you'll see HIV. And heavily concentrated among the injection drug users, all of which fits the known epidemiology. I will tell you that if we had done the same study 10 or 15 years before we did it, which was in the early part of this decade, 2003, 2004, times like that, we would have seen almost this many pluses for HIV, at least among the injectors. Because at that time, 40 to 60% of the injectors would have been infected with HIV. And what's happened since then is needle exchange, which meant the rate of new infections went way downhill. And when you mix that with people either dying or quitting injecting or otherwise leaving the scene, you get the picture of the previous slide where there was very little HIV around and mainly among gays, if you look at that. Now, I'm now going to talk about what underlies what I just showed you in terms of some of the thinking. Most HIV epidemiology, prevention, and policy focuses on individual knowledge, attitudes, personalities, and behaviors. My guess is if you're part of any studies of HIV epidemiology or prevention, that's almost entirely the kinds of variables they are measuring, plus various psychological variables and stuff like that. And ignoring the fact that people also have social and behavioral ties of various different kinds and various different strengths. And so that the same people looked at this way as a bunch of isolated individuals, maybe patients who present for your care, looked at this way, you begin to get some of the underlying substance behind what they do, why they do, and how viruses spread, and how, for that matter, social messages spread among these people. Now, if we look at it in terms of a risk network, and for HIV, a risk network primarily comes down to injecting drugs together or having sex together. One way to look at a risk network is look at the dyad. What's happening in that dyad? Another is to focus on an individual and to say, what is that person's individual, what we call an egocentric network, look like? And this is their network. And you can study infection or behavioral patterns based on the characteristics of these three people and their ties. And we have done papers on that. You can also look at the entire kind of picture of a network I showed you, and the virus will go through a community or small group, starting with one person and then spreading, presumably. That's the basic way in which viruses spread, if we're talking about HIV and Hep C. Now, what does it take to become infected? Because it's much more complicated, and I'll show you a diagram in a second that talks about what I'm about to talk about in words in a picture. It's a conditional probability. If you and I do something of a risk nature together, have sex or inject drugs, what's going to condition whether or not I get infected, assuming I'm not infected to begin with? First of all, I'm not going to get infected if you're not infected. Simple, simple, obvious point. But it's behind an awful lot of the epidemiology of both these viruses. Whether or not, if I have a partner, that person is infected is based in part on my location in those community networks I showed you pictures of. We have shown, for example, that, and I'll talk about this more with a picture in front of you in a couple minutes, that if I'm kind of in the middle dense parts of a network, I'm more likely to have an infected partner for HIV, at least in a study we did in New York about 15 years ago. It's also based, as we all know, on my risk history and your risk history. If I am your first partner ever, you're not likely to be infecting me with either HIV or Hep C. And if I'm That's also, though, a question of what have you done and what have I done in the past, which is based on social history, social influences we've been under our entire lives. If I've never known anyone who injects drugs, the chances are quite high I won't be injecting drugs, for example. Now, then there's the questions of, you not merely have to be infected to infect me, you have to be infectious. You have to have enough of the virus in you to be able to give me enough so that it takes, so that I get infected from it. So that depends on a lot of things about you. Are you in antiretroviral treatment for HIV, in which case your viral load is likely to be much lower and I'm less likely to get infected? Are you alternatively severely malnourished? Do you have various parasites like some of the worms which may increase your infectivity to me? Do you have a sexually transmitted infection? And if so, what has it done to the physical surfaces of, say, your sexual organs that may affect whether the virus transfers from you to me? All of these issues influence whether or not I get infected. And, of course, all those same things pretty much have to do with how susceptible I am. Things that affect my immune system, things that affect the integrity of my mucosa in terms of sex, whatever, all depends on social factors. And if I've ever had an STI, did I get it treated in a way that keeps me from being more susceptible? Now, a lot of these same things will affect the probability that when you and I do whatever we do together, we do it in a dangerous way, which is the behavior we do together. Do we use condoms? Do we share needles? Which is what 90% of the prevention effort so far has focused on. That one item on this whole list of things that affect the conditional probability. So clearly, if we want to prevent the spread of viruses, we have to think more broadly than people think when they only think in terms of behaviors. This just shows the same thing I just said in a pretty diagram. Does this person get infected? Well, it depends on this person's conditions, and this person's, and this person, and this person's conditions depend on their place in the network. Now, what do we know about networks? This is risk networks. This is my IU study of injection drug users about 15 years ago. We showed that the folks in what are called microstructures, which are basically dense places with a lot more interconnectivity among people, of a big component, so there's more ways it can get into the microstructure, are more likely to be infected with HIV. And more likely, I might add, to be exposed to hepatitis B, because we tested for that also, than the folks in the ends of, these, not in the microstructures, but in the big components or in the littler components. And they're also more likely, by the way, these same people to be engaging in health communication to tell other people how to be safer. So that, on the one hand, this is where you've got a strong probability of infection going on because of the behaviors and other things going on and the presence of the virus. But on the other hand, people are actively working to reduce that. I might add it by way of comparison, by the way, when we did this study, Rich Rothenberg, John Potterat, and their colleagues were doing a study of injection in sexual networks in Colorado Springs. What they found was that HIV was not present in these kinds of microstructures. The little bit of HIV around was only in the small, tiny components or at the very ends of long streams of connectivity within the connected big component, which they found. And we have hypothesized, both their team and ours, collectively and together, that this is the reason why Colorado Springs has maintained its low HIV prevalence is because it just hasn't penetrated into these areas, which they then said one of the things they had to do to keep that true was to focus on otter prevention right there. I want to apply this to thinking about acute HIV infection and its implications for HIV epidemics. There's been a lot of discussion in recent years about if we can get to the people who have just recently been infected, we may be able to stop a lot of the transmission of HIV that goes on. And I'm going to show you some of the logic behind that and some of what little is known about it. The basic thing about the infection with HIV, which is important for this, is that very early in your infection, you develop a very, very high viral load. The virus is spreading through your body. There's no antibody to keep it in check. And within a few weeks or months, the antibody goes, where's the antibody sitting? Here it is. It goes up, and when it goes up, begins to come, down comes the viral load. Now, during that period right here, you are much more infectious than during the long latency period. So the question is, what does that mean epidemiologically and in terms of prevention? Now, first of all, this is the Pilcher article on calculated probabilities of transmission per coital act. And you can see that per event, it's much higher in the early weeks of infection. So how does that then help to sustain an epidemic? Some estimates have been that early infection transmission may be responsible for 30 to 50% of all HIV transmission. Hollingsworth and colleagues have suggested that this is going to vary by the stage of the epidemic, which makes lots of sense. Early in an epidemic, you're having a rapid growth in the number of infected individuals. Most of them are, to begin with, in the early stages and therefore infectious, you know, highly infectious, and therefore most of the transmission is going to be from them to other people. Later on in the epidemic, if you get stabilized prevalence levels and stuff like that, most of the people have been infected a long time, so they don't have that pattern. And every now and then, one of them is going to infect somebody else. And simply because of the greater number of them, that may be responsible for much more of the infections than otherwise. And they modeled it and said that in an established epidemic, it might be 11%. And 21% would be due to people who actually had AIDS when they become more infectious again. And 2/3 would be from the asymptomatic folks after they've left the initial infection stuff. What's that mean for prevention? Well, first of all, let me give you another hypothesis that I worked on a paper on, and Dr. Vermund was a co-author on and helped me very much on it, which is the long-term infected, the people who have serious amounts of antibody in their system, if they act as a firewall to protect other people who are negative from this person who is a very high viral load person in network terms. You know, if this person does stuff with them, that person, the protection is not there. But this person cannot convert this person, the hypothesis is, into a high infectivity person just by transmitting some virus from here to there, because this person's antibody will keep that from happening. Now, if you look at that in terms of community networks, and we did do that in our early injector study, what that told us was once you have 40 or 50% of the people in a risk group like injectors in New York infected, the size of people who could be infected by an initial high viral load and early infection person was very small. It's only the person that they have direct contact with and then the people they have direct contact with. So that early in an epidemic, it can go wildfire through the whole community of people at risk. Later on, a lot of those connections are blocked by the people who are infected. And there's some epidemiologic implications of that theory. First of all, you're not going to see what you can call a step function model of infection, where it goes up in the initial burst, then prevalence stabilizes at a reasonably high level. You never see, that I know of, in all the history of HIV, where it goes from this level and then has another huge outburst, like going from 50%, having stabilized at 50% for a long time, and then suddenly shoots up to 80% infected. We just haven't seen that. And yet, in many ways, in many mathematical models, will tell you the 50% point is a period of very high likelihood of new infections occurring. So this may be the explanation. The other vitally important prevention implication of this is that if you're in a situation like New York is in relationship to drug injectors at any rate, or in a lot of other places like in Spain are now in relation to drug injectors, at one time they had some very nasty epidemics, 50-60% of the people being infected. It's now way down, 10-20%. When you have that kind of prevalence, the firewall is not there. So at that point, keeping the behavioral and other forms of prevention strong becomes important. So that, there's a tendency in health departments to say, well, we used to have a bad epidemic among a given group, but now whatever we've done has been successful. We've driven prevalence down to 5-10%. We can spend the money somewhere else. And that's an invitation to have it go right back up again. Now I want to talk about preventing the spread of these viruses in a different way. We usually focus on prevention programs done by public health agencies and medical agencies. I cannot imagine how I did that misspelling that badly. But I did. I'm going to have to fix that in these slides, before I ever use this slide again. Sometimes when we talk about prevention, we also talk about what non-governmental organizations do. And anyone who's been involved in AIDS knows that the NGOs are absolutely critical prevention agents. But in some places, they don't really understand that yet. But before we get into that kind of thinking, we should think about who really does the HIV prevention. I'm going to show, this is the history of New York City HIV epidemic among injection drug users. First thing to understand about it is that by 1979 or so, the injectors in New York knew they had a new disease on their hand that was killing people. When people say we discovered AIDS in 1981, that means there was a 2-year lag between the fact that the drug users knew there was a new disease and when science finally woke up to the fact. Anyone who's concerned about emerging epidemics and emerging infectious diseases should take that very seriously. For a number of diseases, the marginalized people, the most stigmatized people, the most out of it people, are the equivalent of the canaries in the mines for the bad gas in the mines. I don't know if you know about that. Miners used to take canaries down into the mines with them. If the canary died, they knew the air was too bad to breathe and they got out. Well, if you set up mechanisms to listen to what's going on and to observe what's going on among groups like sex workers, drug users, and you name it, depending on what potential disease you're talking about, the poorest of the poor, the most marginalized, some of the time, not all of the time, you will find out that there are new epidemics coming well before we otherwise would. So 2 years later, medicine discovers AIDS. Now, we know from some retrospective oral histories we have done in New York, and we know from interviews we did in 19, 84 and stuff about people's past behaviors at that time, that already by the early 1980s, injectors had figured out share syringes less and with fewer people. And somewhere around here, prevalence at least began to level off. And we don't have any direct data on incidence, but everything we've been able to do modeling suggests that incidence began to level off there too. Now, one could argue that that was because of network saturation. What's her name? I'm blocking on her first name. Blower. Sally Blower has made that argument. One of the things we did in our network study of injectors, although these data were in the early 90s, so we couldn't show it for sure back here, but we showed that in a very profound sense, the networks were not saturated. We showed that most of the dyads or larger groups where there was an infected person also had an uninfected person in it, which is the exact opposite of any meaning of saturation of networks. So it looks like reducing sharing by the injectors probably reduced the transmission of HIV by 1983 or 1984, at which point there was essentially no prevention going on in New York State. The first serious prevention for drug users in New York began to happen in 1986 or 87 with outreach programs. And then, based in part on direct activism by a combination of drug injectors, ex-drug injectors, ACT UP members, which is a heavily gay but also included some ex and current drug users, activist group that was at that time very active in AIDS politics, and some of the staff in some of my research projects. They formed illegal needle exchanges, forced the hand of this state, which said we're going to allow syringe exchange. It then became very large, and nowadays the incidence rate is down from here. It was about 13%. It's under 1% per year now among the uninfected. This is the history of the epidemic among injectors. You will notice the incredible importance I am giving here to the action of the injectors themselves. And the most effective programs that had any serious involvement of public health agencies only came around 1991 or 92, 17 years after the start of the HIV epidemic among New York injectors, which started around 1975, we know from stored bloods, and 15 years after the users themselves figured out there was a problem. So I get very jaded when people talk about public health prevention as if it's only the activity of public health agencies. And this is not only New York. In Rotterdam in the Netherlands, the largest seaport in Europe, by 1982-83, there were organizations of active drug users. They got some funding from the city to do some public health work somewhere around then. And they were very active in AIDS prevention work and started their own needle exchange and stuff like that. And they managed to hold the prevalence of HIV. The epidemic had started when they did that. But they managed to hold the prevalence never got above 10% of the people infected, which for an HIV epidemic among injectors that get started is doing pretty well. In Buenos Aires, where the virus didn't really enter as far as we know until later in the 80s, the users were figuring out what was going on and communicating with it well before there were any serious prevention efforts, which didn't start until the mid-90s. In Central Asia, most of what's being done in prevention at this stage is being done by users and their families and their neighbors talking together and trying to figure out how to keep from sharing works and other stuff. I've belabored the activities of drug users because most people don't know about it. It is also true that gay men, lesbians, and sex workers all over the world have engaged in risk reduction activities to prevent the spread of HIV among them. And this is a combination of the formally organized action, like, for example, the Sex Workers Union in Calcutta, that has been so successful in stopping HIV transmission in that venue, and what I call micro-social action of the kind that the drug injectors in New York did. What it involves when you talk about micro-social action is social networks within relationships to or from an individual and through a community or small group, where I, for example, am the first person in New York to say, hey, there's a new infection going on. How can we prevent it among ourselves? And I tell you, and you tell three people, and it spreads through the community, partly because I might repeat it a lot of times, and so might you. Maybe then somebody gets the idea, maybe we should share needles less. And then they spread that to each other, and it goes through the community. We have given the name intravention, I-N-T-R-A-V-E-N-T-I-O-N, for community-based autonomous health communication, which, by the way, can conceivably and may often be telling lies, not lies, but untruths, things people think are true but aren't. And one role that, of course, public health can for sure play is to find out about those untruths and then do some correction of those untruths when we find them, particularly if it's necessary to stop untruth. Now, how do community organizations relate to networks? Because as Sten was talking about at the beginning, people talk about organizations and communities. So you're working with some community group. I don't know the names of the groups in Nashville, but, you know, Nashville Against HIV, whatever it's called. And that's the CBO, community-based organization over here. And it does things to try to prevent HIV. Now, it's got maybe as part of its members several people who are in the risk groups. In addition, that's if it's a good organization, it does. Some of them don't. Those people then have connections to other people in the risk groups. But then there's other folks they don't have connection with. I will tell you, if you look at any organization, if you go to Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York, they will have contact with a lot of gay men through this, you know, of communication ties. And there's all sorts of gay men in New York they have no connection with whatsoever. If you go to the Rotterdam Drug Users Union I was talking about before, the same thing is true. They have connection with some groups and not with others. So one of the obvious things one needs to do is help them establish ways of communicating beyond their already existing networks. The New South Wales Users and AIDS Association, which is the drug users organization in Sydney, Australia, got funding from their state government to set up what they called the Tribes Project. And they systematically went to other groups of drug users they knew existed in Sydney. They hunted them up. For example, the biker gangs who were using amphetamines as among other things they were using. And they went and worked with them to set up their own equivalent user group to spread protection messages and so forth. This concept of taking your organization and spreading it so you can reach all of a community is a basic part of what you've got to do if you talk about prevention. Lots of NGOs will tell you they're in connection with the entire community. They may not be lying. They may think it's true. Almost always, they're wrong when they say that. And the issue then is to help them or alternative or other people to establish contact and get things going with the part they're not in communication with. Now, I just want to kind of the end to kind of tie a little bit of this together with a schematic diagram. I'm saying in the community, you've got interventions where people are health communicating. You've got norms, which I haven't talked about much. But norms are, on the one hand, what's inside me? What's proper for me to do? Should I use a condom or not? What do I believe about that? What do I believe about the conditions and circumstances under which I use a condom? There's another form of norms, which we call external norms, which are the communications other people give to me. What are people telling me about, you know, what is my mommy telling me about condom use? What is my best friend telling me about condom use? You name it. That's the norms that impinge upon me from the people in my social world. It's useful to think about the fact that it's not merely the receivers of the norms, but the producers of the norms, the people engaging in intervention, who should be thought about when you think about how do you intervene in a community. How do you not really reach the people at risk, but the people who influence the people at risk? How do you train both of those groups to become proactive in telling other people ways to stay safe? These are, you know, on some level, once we've had this presentation I've given you, ABCs of prevention. I hope it's ABCs of prevention by now. And these then affect how I behave, because there's infinite research showing that norms and health communication affect behaviors. Then we ask, what's a CBO or a public health agency doing that as it influences that? And the answer is, it may sometimes work around this route and directly try to influence the behavior itself. And a lot of health research is based around that model. And seeing if you do a controlled trial with people by intervening on them directly, does that lead to better results than if you don't? And what's called a contamination effect, in research language, what I call is, thank God there's some decent community health activity going on, is that people are talking to each other and spreading the prevention message. And not only is it messages, by the way. If you hand out condoms or syringes, which are, you know, basic HIV prevention tactics that many prevention organizations do, unless you take extraordinarily strong actions to try to prevent it, the people you give those things to will save some of them back and give them to other people to use. Sometimes they may ask for a little bit of money in return, which is called very cheap, low-priced public health agents. But the reality is that people who have studied, for example, the spread of syringes through what's called secondary and satellite syringe exchanging, all of the people who have done those studies conclude that this is something helping the public health. So that this kind of community spread of interventions is a critical part of it, and it will vary depending upon the networks and the rest of it. There are other things, by the way, that affect risk networks. For example, we showed a fairly recent paper that essentially the more police activity there is in a community, the more arrests for hard drug use, the more police per capita, you name it, the higher is HIV prevalence level among injection drug users in that community. I might add analyses we have just been doing as well on longitudinal data, as well as our cross-sectional data that we have published, have shown that those variables do not have any positive impact upon the number of drug injectors in a community. So we're not getting any drug prevention advantage, at least in relationship to injection drug use. But we are seeing HIV being higher, where you've got more of that. And part of that, when you remove people from a network, you shake the network up. You remove people from a network by arresting them, right? And then the result of that is they set up new ties, some of which are going to be between positives and negatives, some of which may be between very high viral load positives and negatives, which otherwise might have been more protective, like positives injecting with positives and stuff like that. So that we've got there's a lot of other stuff I haven't really touched on in this talk that affects the spread of viruses. One of the other final things I'll say, we are trying to understand now why epidemics get started and how to prevent epidemics from getting started. And one of the things to look at in that is some of the really major social, political, economic events that destabilize networks, people's lives, and norms. And so that, you know, helps you to understand what happened in Eastern Europe and Russia after the, you know, fall of the Soviet Union, helps you to understand what happened in South Africa to some extent after the fall of apartheid, and I could go on and on and on. It's not a complete theory yet because we don't know why we didn't have anything happen in the Philippines. That's the end of what I want to talk about. I'm ready for comments, questions, disagreements, statements that I'm stupid, anything you want. Should I call on them or do you want to, Sten? There's somebody in the back who I can barely see. Getting antiretroviral treatment, they may be coming out with AIDS. set AIDS policy. And that prevents stupid things from being done by government and public health agencies, and it even educates people like Dennis, which is terrible.
We have hands 1, 2, and 3. Go ahead.
Could you comment a little bit on the potential differences of what to expect for networks in places like in Africa in terms of differences in people for social operations and also the state of the epidemic in Africa?
I can trust. Africa is not an area I've done a lot of work with. From what I know about the literature, first of all, there's no such thing as Africa.
That's what?
There's no such thing as Africa in the Israel. There's lots of geographic locations, and within geographic locations, you've got various different social groups. So that, you know, the tendency which Dr. Stuhlwagen here in the audience is one of the people who has written some profound and good stuff on, is to take stereotypes or very localized anthropologic studies and, let's say, what you want to hear, namely people are sex crazed maniacs, because that is the stereotype of Africa on the, you know, of a racist kind, and take whatever little tiny bits of evidence you can find for that argument and say that's Africa as a whole, which is, of course, wrong. Now, the studies that have been done of sexual networks in Africa show that they operate somewhat like what I've been showing you. One difference is injection networks. All those red and blue lines I showed you in the diagram tend to be very, a person tends to have more long-term injection networks than sexual networks. So when you talk about what's called a network term degree, how many partners you have, first of all, for almost everybody, an injector tends to be somewhat larger on the average than for sex. Secondly, that a lot of them are long-term, which leads to different social behavior and other dynamics in it. From a very short term thing, like the sex worker networks I showed you. Although the ones I showed you on, you know, the Nancy Arample picture are ones where the people have enough of a connection to the sex worker so that she is able to tell Valencia or her interviewer about what this person is doing. So that, you know, those are some of the more stable ones. There's also the, you know, one event thing. So that's part of not full answer, because there's a lot we don't know yet.
I was curious about the association of increased police presence and HIV prevalence. I was wondering whether this could have something to do with communities that maybe have higher drug use or higher risk behaviors and therefore have higher police calls and police problems rather than disruption of social networks.
Two things.
question briefly.
I was just wondering, I was curious as to what your predictions are for the HIV epidemics in America and around the world in relation to the actions that are currently being taken.
Very uncertain. And part of the reason I say that, I don't know the social future of the world. I will tell you the global warming stuff is what leads to mass migration away from coastlines and all the social conflict that's going to result from that and all the network mixing and demoralized people. That's bad stuff. Every time a new war starts, that's a bad stuff. You know, those guys, God only knows what the impact of the economic collapse that may be coming upon us. It may just be a slump. It may be a lot worse. Depending on how deep it is and how long it is, the resources for a lot of these prevention efforts and these medical care efforts, like PEPFAR, which, you know, involves billions of dollars, if the economy tanks long enough and strong enough, that money may disappear. So that's what most worries me about the future of the epidemic. I'm also very worried about spread sexually outwards from the injectors in the former Soviet Union. The Indian situation, if its economic growth continues as rapidly as it has been in some areas, with this amount of HIV that's already there, could get very destabilized, probably similarly for China. They are definitely mounting, in some areas, some very impressive efforts to try to prevent that. So I have no predictions beyond saying I'm very worried. And the other thing I want to say is, to the extent we're depending on antiretrovirals, we're in a horse race. So far, it looks like we're winning, not in terms of getting the care out there. More people are getting infected every year than are getting the treatment. But in terms of the antiviral resistance, we don't know how long the menu is of feasible medical interventions against this virus of the kind that go into heart. We're hoping we can find some that have low mutation rates and great efficacy at keeping the thing under control. We could run out of that menu, either because there's nothing out there in reality that we can do, we run out of good treatment, or because the economic basis for doing the research disappears because of either economic difficulties or clinical difficulties, in which case you could see conceivable some problems with, you know, mutant strains that are resistant, essentially recreating the epidemic around what can be treated.
On that note, we'd like to thank Dr. Friedman for visiting Vanderbilt. Thank you.